Fighting wars over oil and gas. No matter who wins, it will not last. The earth is scarred, the planet is warming. Don't you think that all of it's a great big warning?
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's
All right. We will learn the powerhouses and cars. This is Harvey Wasserman with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to talk mostly about wind power today. I have Bob Goff with us. Bob, are you there?
I am here, Harvey. Good to hear you.
All right. And are you where? Where are you right now, Bob?
Actually, I'm in Colorado, just in Boulder, Colorado. But,
Boulder, Colorado. Less liberal, Boulder, Colorado. Okay, good. So I usually do an intro talking about nuclear power at the beginning of the show, but I know you've got to go. You've got another commitment. So let's talk straight and get right into wind power. We won't talk about the radioactive tuna that have been irradiated by Fukushima that are being caught off the state of California now. We'll come back to that later since you're in Boulder. It doesn't affect you directly unless you're eating tuna from California. But you are Bob Goff, G-O-U-G-H, a leading light in the campaign among the Native American community to get wind power. And this is a big, 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 big deal. So, Bob, can you tell us, you're an attorney, or you've been an activist for God knows how long, and you have been at the center of the attempt of the tribes of Native America, especially in the Great Plains, to get wind power going out there. So can you tell us a bit about what's happening there?
Sure. Tribes have been looking at wind power seriously for over the last decade, and with the work done with the Department of Energy, the National Renewable Energy Lab, Wind Powering America program, and the Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy programs at the DOE, tribes have worked with those agencies to secure some funding to do a number of things, looking at first steps to see what potential renewable energy resources they may have and want to bring to bear onto their reservations. There's been about 77 feasibility studies looking at wind and solar primarily, but also geothermal, some hydropower, small-scale hydropower and the like. There's been about 20-plus development projects done over these last 10 years to the tune of about 159 projects altogether, 160 projects altogether for about $36 million looking at these resources.
Well, Bob, who has funded these? Is this coming all federal money? Where's the money coming from for these?
That has been money just from the Department of Energy. The National Renewable Energy Lab lent out a lot of anemometers so that the tribes could get some initial indication of what their wind resources
look
like.
All right, so anemometers are devices that you stick up on a tower that measure wind speed and consistency.
That's correct.
You need an anemometer on a site before you put in a windmill to find out if you can actually sustain a windmill profitably.
That's correct. You want to be able to determine what your long-term, over at least 1 year's worth of data, and then you compare that to other sites to see if that's a normal year, an extremely windy year, or a slow wind year, just so that you get an idea that what the economics of a project might be worth to you, so you can tell whether or not it's worth putting that project in.
Okay, and so the Department of Energy has used our taxpayer money to fund, you say, 139 different projects in Indian country. What states would that be?
What states? It's all over the West. Actually, it's all over the country. Maine,
okay.
Penobscot in Maine, the Seneca in New York, probably about eight tribes in Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, the Dakotas, out to Washington State, all throughout the West, certainly in California, and then the Southwest with a lot of solar projects.
Oh, so it's solar and wind. And what's been the upshot? What successfully is operating now in terms of wind power for Native American communities out of this program?
I'm sorry, what was...
What are the successful projects? Do you have windmills that are up and running and producing electricity now because of this federal money, and how well are they working?
There have been a number of smaller projects, single turbine projects, that have gone in. There's only really been one large utility scale project, and that's gone in California with the Campo Band in Southern California down by San Diego. And while that was a successful project, it's about 50 megawatts, it's not tribally owned because of the tax credit structure. The federal incentives are in the form of tax credits, and because tribes as governments are not taxed, as no city is taxed for income tax, no county is taxed, no government is taxed by the federal government for income tax, and yet the only incentives they provide are an income tax credit that the businesses can use, but tribal governments as project owners can't use. So therefore, most of the projects that could go in to Indian country have not, because tribes aren't able to assert ownership in those contexts. So it's a
catch 22, isn't it? The federal government has money to build wind machines, to help the building of wind machines on Indian land, but the Indians can't own them, and get the federal money, because the money's not in form of cash. It's in the form of,
tax credits. An incentive in form of tax credits. So that basically the same wind resource that's on a reservation or right next door to it, and similar projects could be proposed, and a project owned by non-Indians could get a 2.5 cent credit, 2.2 cent, I think is what it is right now, credit going into the market on every kilowatt hour that they produce. And a tribe with the very same wind resource just across the street could not go into the same market because they don't have that incentive. So tribes come into the market with a 2 cent penalty, whereas private companies would have a 2 cent incentive to go into that same market. And you can't compete against someone when the actual wind projects, the power purchase agreements for these projects, come down to mill rates. They come down to tenths of a penny in order to be able to be competitive.
All right, we're talking with Bob Goff. Bob, what is your official title here, and what organization are you representing?
I'm the secretary of the Intertribal Council on Utility Policy. It's an organization, tribally chartered organization in the Northern Great Plains, with about 15 tribes in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, Nebraska.
And how long have you been doing that?
Well, we've been doing that since about 1994. Working with tribes on renewable energy issues and energy efficiency.
All right, and so it's Intertribal COUP that your organization is generally referred to as, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and we're joined on the phone now by Christina Raleigh. Christina, are you there?
Hello.
Hi, Christina. Okay.
Hi.
This is Christina Raleigh. You're talking to us from Falmouth, Massachusetts. Joining Bob Goff here, and Christina, you are involved with the wind issue on Cape Cod. Do you have any connection with the Mashpee or any other tribe on the Cape or in the islands that is involved with wind power that might be of interest to Bob, who's working with the tribes of the West?
Oh, gee, I don't. Ron, I think you're on the line, too.
Yes. Oh, Ron Zweig is with us as well. So we have Christina Raleigh and Ron Zweig in Falmouth, who are working on wind issues. And you have been on the show before, so I want to follow up on what's happening with wind on the Cape.
Right.
None of the local tribes are involved with you as yet. Is that correct?
That's right. So far as I know, they're mostly tied up with casinos.
Oh, all right. Well, yes, and the casinos actually started to take a nosedive, but we won't talk about that today.
Okay.
Let me return to Bob Goff, now that we know you're here. And feel free, Chris, around and jump in at any time.
Okay.
Bob is working with the Intertribal Council of Native Americans in the West. And as we know, Bob, can you describe actually the potential for wind power in the Great Plains with on tribal land? What can we really get out of in terms of energy production?
Well, in terms of the potential, I've made my home since 1986 on the Rosebud Reservation, and one of the counties on Rosebud, Todd County, it's about 30 miles wide and 60 miles across in the center of the Great Plains in the southern part of South Dakota. That 60 miles by 30 mile rectangle has about a 50 gigawatt potential. 50,000 megawatts of wind could be produced there. It's tremendous potential. Indian country altogether.
Well, 50 nuclear power plants. So that basically be about a half of the electricity production of the 104 nuclear plants in the United States.
Yeah, there you go. That's a good way to think
from
of it.
From one county. Of course, there's a problem with transmitting it, but you can certainly do that with currently available technology.
Well, we're actually looking at some storage technologies that may bypass the transmission system as well, but that's a whole other question. But that's the opportunity of taking advantage of the 200 gigawatts or so of wind power potential in Indian country that could be available and put onto the grids is something tribes are working towards. That would represent maybe 20% ballpark of what the whole country uses on a regular basis for power, just coming from wind that would be available. And that's not all the available wind. That's only at 50, it was measured at 50 meters. Today we're now getting wind at 100 meters and above. So there's a greater wind potential there than has been previously measured.
Well, 20% of the American electricity production is pretty much what we get from nuclear. So what you're saying is that even at a low hub height, even at a less than the full potential, we clearly have as much wind potential in Indian country alone. This is on reservations, as is produced by the American nuclear power industry. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That's correct.
Now, Chris and Ron, in Cape Cod, you're looking at the possibility now of moving ahead with the Cape Wind project. Can you tell us, and I'm sure Bob will be interested to hear, what is the status of Cape Wind and what's the possible electrical generating capacity to come out of it?
Ron?
Oh, yeah. I thought you were going to jump in, Christina. Well, Cape Wind basically is going through its final stages of approval. I think that one thing that it was working on was the selling of the power it would generate. It's going to be 130 turbines. I think they're about 3 megawatts each, and so they're quite large. And so they will be a bit larger than that even. Producing, I think it's about 75%, if I'm correct, in my memory, of basically the power needs of Cape Cod by itself. And although the power will go where it goes through a couple of utilities, NSTAR and Northeast Utilities. And so it's in its final stages of approval. They're going through some public meetings now with the Department of Public Utilities to listen to people. And at a recent meeting we went to in Hyannis, there was a strong outpouring of support that actually was much greater than those who raised concerns over the project. So,
so
that one is moving.
You are supportive of it. Bob has mentioned there are about the windmills in Indian country, there are complications in terms of tax credits and who owns it. Who would own the Cape Wind project?
Well, the Cape Wind project is by in itself by a private developer, and so it is going to be developed by Jim Gordon is the I think the CEO of the company, and so it is a private investment.
Whereas so, the turbines in Falmouth are a municipal investment owned by the taxpayers of the town.
What's on, Christina? Which turbine? Not the ones at the Cape Wind project. You have turbines at Falmouth that are owned by the town. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay. And so, Bob Goff, we're talking here. How many turbines did you say, Ron, would be going in the Cape Wind project?
About 130, and they're about 3 miles offshore.
How many?
130.
Yeah, but how many miles offshore?
About 3 miles.
3 miles. And
yeah, there's an area that's sort of 3 miles from Cape Cod, 3 miles from Martha's Vineyard, and 3 miles from Nantucket in Vineyard Sound. So it's a little area out there.
So you're talking about 390 or 400 megawatts of capacity, which is
about... a bit more than 400, yeah.
More than 400. So that's a little under half what we usually use as a rule of thumb for a nuclear plant. Bob Goff, that's pretty far in excess of anything you've got going in Indian country, or is that not the case? You mentioned a 50-megawatt project in California.
That is far more than is up and running in Indian country, yes.
Is there any project in Indian country that's on a scale of what's projected here for Cape Wind?
Yes, we've proposed to Western Area Power Administration, which is the federal transmission operator in the Great Plains and in the American West, we've proposed a 400-megawatt wind project consisting of about 50 megawatts on each of 10 reservations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Nebraska, Montana. And that kind of a project would be 50 megawatts on each of 10 reservations. And then ultimately, we've got about 24 reservations out here with good winds, and we'd like to see something of that order, 50 to 150 megawatts on each of those reservations. But the problem there is really transmission.
Okay, Bob, so let's talk about the problems, because when we talk further with Chris Moran about the Cape, we're going to talk about the problems there, too. This is Harvey Wasserman. I'm talking to you actually from Cape Cod. On the Green Power Wellness Show, we have Bob Goff of the Native American wind industry, essentially, the tribal association that's trying to bring wind into the Great Plains, into the reservations, and with Chris Rowley and Ron Zweig in Falmouth, Massachusetts. They have been facing some amazing resistance to wind power, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, Bob, you have mentioned barriers, transmission, and other problems in bringing wind power into the to Great Plains and into the reservation lands. Can you give us what's the holdup? I mean, you've been doing this since 1994. One would expect, given the nature of the environmental crisis that we face and the politics, or well, at least the economics of wind power, which have been doing nothing but improving over the last 20, 30 years. What is the holdup? If you have sufficient wind capacity in the Great Plains, just on reservation land alone, to produce 20% of the electricity in the United States, which is what nuclear does, more or less, and it's actually less, what's the problem? Why isn't it happening? Let
me start by asking the folks out there in the Northeast, how much does the average resident pay per kilowatt hour for electricity? What's your cost of electricity out there?
About
20%. What do you get on your electric bill? How much you pay a kilowatt hour?
Well, it's about 20. Well, we don't pay right now, but 22 cents.
Oh, you
well, it's been going down lately.
Okay. Chris and Ron are bad people to ask that, because they actually have an operating windmill at their house, which provides all their wind power. So,
right.
If theoretically you were paying the utility company, what would you be paying?
22 cents.
22 cents, a local market of 22 cents. That is a great market to be able to sell wind into, when you realize you're paying about the same price no matter where you are in the country for the equipment, for the wind technology itself. And then you put that up, and if you've got good enough winds, you can produce electrons, you can produce electricity at a certain price. We are in a market where right now people pay 6 to 8 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're competing against coal, which is maybe 2.5 cents, 3 cents a kilowatt hour retail. And just recently we had the 500-year flood on the Missouri River, which is what produces our hydropower, and Western Area Power Administration was selling power for 1.3 cents a kilowatt hour.
Wow.
So we have to compete with that market, and it's hard to even get, you know, 5-cent wind, 3-cent wind, and it's very hard to build 3-cent wind when you don't have a tax credit of 2 cents on top of that. To be able to compete against lignite coal where they're burning dirt. So that's
right.
Been the biggest problem.
Exactly.
If we could get our power to your market, we could do it. We could do it on 1 foot.
On top of that, we get a renewable energy credit of 3 cents a kilowatt hour, and for
is that
wind.
State or federal, Ron?
State, and then there's another. But if you do solar. It's amazing right now. It's like it's over 50 cents a kilowatt hour as a renewable energy credit. So
right.
It's.
But what does a renewable energy credit translate into? If you're a ratepayer and you put in a solar system that feeds electricity into the grid, what does this 50 cents mean? How does it translate? Do you get a check for it, or is it off your taxes?
You get a check.
You get a check. From
yeah.
Who? From what? The utility or from the state?
From the state.
Oh, my God. And what do you cost in Massachusetts to put up a solar panel and to generate that electricity? Is there a way to calculate the cost per kilowatt hour to a producer?
Yeah, I think that, well, it depends. I mean, here people are doing very well with the technology as it stands, and I think there's almost 5-year payback period. And we don't have solar, we have wind.
If I have a house on Cape Cod and I want to put in a solar panel and sell the electricity back into the grid, I can get a 50 cent a kilowatt hour check from the state of Massachusetts for doing that?
No, it's better than that. You get 50 cents on every kilowatt hour that you produce, including that you use. So it isn't just everything that's going into the grid. It's the gross production.
This is cash money?
Cash.
Wow. That's pretty great.
Right.
Why doesn't every house in Massachusetts have solar panels?
The Green Communities Act.
Well, some friends of ours generated last year, they have an 8-kilowatt unit, and they generated about 10 megawatts. And so it's about $500 a megawatt. So, so that's $5,000 a year they're getting from the state just for the REC.
And what did the unit cost them to put in?
I think it cost them about $50,000 to put it in.
So it's a 10-year payback.
But then you get the tax credit on top for the installation, which is 30% from the federal, and then there were some state credits as well.
How long would it take you to pay back your unit?
I think it was about 5 years.
5 years.
The rate
okay.
they're going.
Bob, are you working with anything comparable to that in Indian Country?
We don't have those environments in the Great Plains. There are some better incentives for renewables in places like California, where you've got a lot of tribes, but very small land bases. Throughout the West, a lot of tribes are looking to see how they might be able to get their power onto the grid and sell into California. But we're a little too far from there to make that profitable at this point, because you've got so much transmission systems you'd have to cross, and each one adds their own toll, if you will, their own wheeling charges, and it just becomes too expensive to ship it from the Dakotas to California or to Massachusetts at this point.
So what you're facing in the Great Plains, you don't have states that have, do any of the states in the Great Plains where some of the reservations are located have state incentives to that would make it more profitable and more attractive to put up windmills there?
Well, Wisconsin and Minnesota have had them at various times. Wisconsin has been sort of in a retreat now under the current administration, but we're not seeing incentives anywhere near the kind that you're seeing on the East Coast.
Well, we're talking with Bob Goff of the Native American wind industry and Christina Raleigh and Ron Zweig in Falmouth on Cape Cod. They have experienced, Chris and Ron have experienced some incredible resistance to wind power, and it actually made national news recently, at least on the Internet. And we'll talk about that after the break. This is the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show with Harvey Wasserman. And we're talking about wind power today. Just a minute before the break here, Bob, what about any federal money? You're saying that it's tied up. I think it might be confusing to the listeners. The federal tax credits are only good for private investors. Is that correct?
Correct. It's the debt for the tax credits.
Let's hold that thought. Bob, here, let's hold that thought. We'll go into the break. We'll talk about that as soon as we come back, and then we'll let you go. Thanks so much. Just be a minute.
In air, water, rooftop, gardens, tidal geothermal power, family, community, healthy children, and lots of forest for the
Solartopia, we're back here. That was the great Dana Lyons, Cows with Guns, of Cows with Guns fame, singing the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. We're on talking about wind power. We may be joined later, we're not sure yet, by Elliot Nagin of the Union of Concerned Scientists. He has a piece up at Huffington Post today about the production tax credit, which is in jeopardy of going away. It's a an incentive used to get investments in wind power a tax break. And we've talked a little bit about a similar situation with Bob Goff here. Bob is from the Native American wind community, been pushing since 1994 for expanded wind power in the Great Plains, the reservations out there. And we're also joined by Christina Raleigh and Ron Zweig, who've been working for and with wind power. They have a wind power at home in Cape Cod. I know you've got to go, Bob. So what can you tell us finally about where we're at with wind power in the Great Plains? I mean, you've told us essentially that we could get 20% of our electricity in the United States at least from currently available wind technology installed on reservation land, Indian country out west. What is the holdup? Do you have, and we're going to talk about some really amazing resistance to wind power in Cape Cod. Have you run into the anti-wind forces that are actually opposing windmills?
Well, from the reservation perspective, most of the tribal governments have been very supportive of trying to get these projects built for a number of reasons. Tribal sovereignty and energy sovereignty go hand in hand, and you can't say you're really sovereign if your entire economy can have the plug pulled by some outside utility. So there's those considerations that the tribes have here, and we're in a region that desperately needs economic development, and new industries bring new jobs. Old industries tend not to create new jobs. So we're looking at the opportunity to be able to get renewables going on the reservations. The biggest opposition has come from the vested interests, the coal interests. And where we live, they're able to burn lignite coal, which is the most carbon-intensive coal of all around the country. So we're looking at the worst greenhouse gas coal going into the atmosphere and polluting the air, polluting the water with mercury. And we'd like to see that alternative come from clean energy, and that clean energy come from Indian country.
And do you have people who are actually working in the wind industry there? Has it created jobs, any kind of jobs in Indian country?
Well, there's a lot of work that's been done, like I said, on the feasibility studies, on doing the measurements. We know what resources we have, and if we can't get them up to be utility scale, large projects like the ones your folks have been talking about off the Cape Wind kind of project, we're looking to see what we can do in terms of community scale projects. And one of the issues there is that that becomes a direct competition to the existing utilities. Utilities don't mind if we build a lot of wind and send it someplace else. That doesn't challenge their market. But if we're going to be using it locally, that's a direct challenge to their markets, and they're concerned about that because they've pledged our meters to pay off their coal plant bills and the debt that they've taken on for that. And a lot of the tribes would just as soon have their power come from local resources rather than from coal plants. So we are looking at community wind, and we're looking at ways of storing that power and firming the wind, both using it, firming it with hydropower, but also storing it in the form of ammonia, liquid ammonia, the kind that farmers have been using on their farms for 60, 70 years now, anhydrous ammonia. You can actually create that with electricity from wind or solar, water, and nitrogen from the air. Combining those in the right combination, you can store those hydrogen electrons as ammonia and therefore make a non-dispatchable intermittent resource like renewables into a dispatchable resource like natural, it function just like natural gas. So that's
all right, very
really
good. Thank you, Bob. We've been talking with Bob Goff. I know you got to go. You have a meeting of some kind. So you've been kind. How do people get a hold of you or look up what's going on at Native, in the Native Wind community?
Intertribalcoup.org is the website that's been out there for some time. Please get a hold of us that way, or you can reach me at goff.bob@gmail.com.
All right, I'll put that up on the website here at PRN. So, Bob Goff, thank you so much for being with us. I look forward to seeing you again. You're a great guy, and it's always a pleasure. Thanks for your great work.
My pleasure being on with you guys today. Solartopia, here we go.
All right, thank you, Bob. Okay, now we're with Christine Aralian-Ronzweig from Falmouth, Massachusetts, a longtime friend of mine. That's an understatement, actually, and doing incredible work on wind. And you have been facing opposition that would be hard to even conceive of. We've talked about this before, but it's gotten worse. And
yes.
So give us a thumbnail idea of what's going on with people fighting against wind power on the Cape.
Well, as you know, the whole Cape wind issue started a very heavy support against wind turbines. Many of the people who live further down on the Cape in the Yarmouth and other Osterville area, who look out on Nantucket Sound, were concerned with the NIMBY effect, actually. They were concerned about it disrupting their views. So with that, many of the people who have summer houses there, some of them with deep pockets in the petroleum industry, including one of the Koch brothers, Bill Koch, who has a house there.
K-O-C-H.
Uh-huh, that's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And he, and so there have been massive millions of dollars that have gone into the opposition there, and that has more or less spilled over across the Cape from town to town as the towns moved from, offshore to land-based turbines. And in Falmouth here, we started looking at wind about a decade ago and had a very thorough, very thorough research on the placement of the turbines on town-owned land and constructed them according to all of the available requirements. And the whole project, two turbines, the whole project went through town meeting about 10 times during the 10 years, each time getting support from all of the townspeople. And then after they were put up, there was a notice for the first time in the Falmouth Enterprise about a meeting that was being held in a house located near the turbines. The meeting was, there were about 7 or 8 people at the meeting, and when you counted exactly who was there, there were representatives from the anti-wind turbine group in that was opposed to the Nantucket Shoals turbines. So that has spilled over into Falmouth, and from there, there have been, over the last 2 years, it's been a very concerted effort by a few people in the town who live near the turbines, and some who don't live so near the turbines, but who are opposed to wind. It is part of the change of culture that we're experiencing here as we move toward, as we are in the transition to renewable energy. So in this town, we have a wonderful wind span. And looking at whether we'd go solar or wind, actually we're using a combination in the town. But the most energy can be produced by wind, clearly. And so the...
And you power your house with wind.
We do.
You have a windmill, and yours is the only one visible on the Cape that I've seen, you know, from the ferry to Martha's Vineyard. And do you get 100% of your electricity from your windmill?
And more.
More.
Yeah, so we get about 150% of our needs, sometimes actually a bit more than that. And so we donate the surplus to charities. And our power company is set up, so we just need to allocate a percentage of the surplus every month to the charity's account. And so then it's deducted. Their electric bills are then reduced by that contribution.
Oh, okay.
Every month.
You're not donating it to the Koch brothers' coal burning fund.
I don't think so. No, absolutely not.
What do people say now when they oppose wind power? What do they say? What's wrong with it? I mean, we've heard all the bird stuff, and we know that windmills. You can, if you really work at it, kill some birds with windmills, but it's hard to do. What do people say now when they're opposing wind power?
Well, there are all sorts of maladies, beginning with loss of sleep, there are several people who have previous conditions. They have come back from, one has come back from the Vietnam War with post-traumatic stress. And so when he sees the turbine, he goes back to the images of helicopters. And so that's one feature. And then others have had other problems with it that seem on the face of it to be related to stress of all sorts. So some people feel weak. They feel like they're going to faint. Sometimes they have high blood pressure, or they feel a lack of concentration, forgetfulness. Some people have muscle twitches, that sort of thing.
Uh-huh.
So,
and this is all because of wind power?
That's what they are attributing it to, yes.
And,
so,
but they did not have, you said earlier that the town was unanimous in welcoming in these windmills in the first place.
Sorry?
You said earlier, I believe, you said the town was unanimous to build
yes.
them in the first place.
Yes, yes.
And how much did they cost?
It cost about $5 million each.
Oh, my God. And so now you, and now these people want to shut them down.
Right.
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 And how successful were they when they were operating?
They do better than they expected from the modeling and the wind tests that were done. They're doing better than when they're operating, but there's been a lot of curtailment because of the issues being raised. So they're not running. One of them is shut down at the moment completely. It actually, there was some sound testing done, and it came out, one of them came out at one location above the state standard in terms of noise emissions by about 2 decibels. In other words, it was a little bit less than 2 decibels, but the limit from above background, the way the regulations are written, is that it should not be emitting more than 10 decibels above the background. Now, the highest that was measured was 50 decibels. A normal conversation is about 60 decibels. So, but the background was about 40. So it was like, you know, or 39 or 30 or actually the yeah, anyway, it was like 12 above the ambient. So that raised some concerns, but it's an interesting ruling in that the lowest audible that you can hear is about 10 decibels. So if you had a silent night and the turbine was running at 25 decibels on a quiet night, it might, you know, with 5 decibels of background noise, you may actually be out of compliance. But it would hardly be noticeable. But anyway, this is one factor that came up, and so this is being examined now. The town's going through more analysis. There are other factors that people have been talking about vibrations and things like that that are also being examined. But there's it's hard to be specific. There's the one thing that's really clear in the neighborhood where they were built, and they were built in a technology park or an industrial park designated for industry. But the closest house, I think, is about 1,250 feet away from one of the turbines. And what's happened is that there is definitely a change in the neighborhood. There is noise, there is the turbine, there are the turbines turning there, and this is something that's changed from previous times. And the main time this time when they measured the turbine being out of compliance was in the middle of the night, and there's an adjacent highway that during the day makes a lot more noise than the turbines do. But as far as the, in some locations around them. And so, so it's hard to really put all this together. Therefore, there's a lot of discussion, a lot of analysis being done to look into how to mitigate the impacts. But people are really bothered by them and by the noise.
How many people is this?
Well, the thing is that right now it's hard to say exactly at the moment, but within a half mile of the turbines as of last November, there were about 168 houses. And of those 168, 14 issued complaints. And they were scattered about, so it depends. And they're houses side by side where the people really do support the turbines and are not bothered by them. You know, the next-door neighbor, literally. And yet the one next to that person is severely affected. I mean, it could be design of house. It could be a lot of different things. But it was only at that time about 7 or 8% of the people within a half a mile. And but that number's gone up since, and so people are now more people are saying that they have an issue with them. The big question is health, and whether there are any health impacts. And all of the studies that have been done on sound related to turbines, all the peer-reviewed studies have not found specific criterion or criteria that has caused a health effect. But
they have not.
There has not been any peer-reviewed studies, and the state just came out with another review of all the peer-reviewed information showing that there hasn't been a
no
direct
link
to turbines and adverse health effects.
And
nevertheless,
the people have been able to shut these windmills down.
They shut down. One of them is, and the other one's running it like for 12 hours, like 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. And they're under study right now. But they've been in kind of a curtailed mode for a while. It's been a very, very well-organized, relatively small group of people, probably about 10, who have gotten very well-organized and really are opposed to them. And across the Cape, it's interesting because there's been this whole kind of move that not only is against turbines, okay, but also against solar power. So,
and they're funded by the Koch brothers, as best you can tell.
Well, we don't. It's hard to know about how all this is done, but the Guardian had an article that made links to the Kochs and to others in the fossil fuel industries that have been apparently organizing an national anti-wind campaign, and indicated in the, although they didn't cite the references specifically, but they said there were documents that they had that showed that there was an effort that you'll start seeing billboards and things like this around the country talking about the problem
wow.
with wind.
So there's a vast right-wing conspiracy against wind power.
Well,
yes.
Plus now, of course, they're citing the whole Solyndra thing and all this other stuff going on. So it's, I think we're really very much in a transition time, and that that what we've seen with Cape Wind, for example, just to give you an example, is that about 2 years ago, Christine and I went to a public hearing on Cape Wind. And I would say...
Hey, by the way, let me interrupt you very quickly, Ron. We do have Elliot Nagin. Elliot, are you on the line? Elliot Nagin?
Hi, good afternoon, everybody.
Hi, Elliot. Okay, this is Elliot. When you join Elliot Nagin from the Union for Concerned Scientists, Elliot has a piece on Huffington Post today about the wind protection tax credit. We're going to be squeezed for time, but Ron's wide from Falmouth. Can you tell us what about the opposition to Cape Wind, and then Elliot, if you'll fill us in on what's happening with the PTC, that'd be great.
Okay.
Ron, go ahead, please. Ron from Falmouth.
Well, I'm just saying that basically there's been this I think we're in a transition period, and that ultimately, but coming back to Cape Wind for a moment, 2 years ago we were at a meeting and it was like 90% against. And then we went to a meeting just this past last week where it was like at least two-thirds for the project. So it's changing. I think we're in a transition period. People are starting to look at climate change, starting to look at health effects of these other power plants, fossil nuclear, and the risks. And starting then, Fukushima kind of was a big wake-up call for a lot of people. And I think that there is a movement, and this was a group of people who were like teenagers to very senior citizens coming out in favor. And then the
favor of wind power.
Yeah.
Okay, so now, Chris and Ron, I'm sorry, I don't lose you, but we're down to kind of the end of the show.
Right.
Please, first of all, I'll be speaking with you Saturday night. What location are we speaking at?
That's right, at Alchemy Farm.
At Alchemy Farm in Woodfull or Falmouth, Massachusetts. And
that's right.
Is there a website that people can go to talk with you about wind?
We have a Friends of Falmouth Wind Facebook site. So
okay.
Go to Friends of Falmouth Wind, and you'll see all of the material that we've gathered here pro-wind in Falmouth.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. And if stay on the line if you like, but we got to ask Elliot to come on.
Sure.
This is timely, and I don't know if the PTC
attack. Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you, Chris Riley and Ron Zweig. Thank you so much.
See you Saturday night.
Stick with us, yes, and if you like. And Elliot, we've been talking about wind power first in Indian Country and now on Cape Cod. And your article today on Huffington talks about the production tax credit. Can you tell us real quickly about that and what people might do if they want to preserve it?
Sure, Harvey. The production tax credit sounds like a real sort of in the weeds, wonky thing, but what it is. It's been a tax break that's been around since the early 1990s that gives wind project developers a break and basically it gives them a credit of 2.2 cents per kilowatt hour of electricity produced by wind turbines for the first 10 years of production. And what essentially that does is it helps level the playing field between fossil fuels, nuclear power, and wind. Especially coal and nuclear power and wind when it comes to electricity. And it also helps wind developers finance new projects. So it's really been critical. And unlike a lot of the permanent subsidies for fossil fuels and nuclear power, this one is only extended by Congress for a few years at a time. So every 3-4 years it comes up for a vote again. And it's coming up for a vote again to be renewed by the end of this year. And it's become a political football. So this particular tax break is really critical for the wind industry. The wind industry predicts that if it doesn't get this tax credit extended, it will probably have to lay off close to half of its workforce, which would be about 37,000 people will lose their jobs, and a lot of projects will not go forward because of this, because Congress keeps playing footsies with the wind industry.
Wow. Well, listen, Elliot, unfortunately, we love Pete Seeger, but that's him letting us know that we're close to the end of the show.
All right. Well, anyway.
If you can invite, if you can think about joining us next week, I'd like to go into this.
Sure. And my piece is, sure, I'd be happy to do that. My piece is on Huffington Post right now. Just Google my name on Huffington Post, Elliot Nagin, that's N-E-G-I-N, and you can find the piece.
All right, so if you can join us next week at the Solar Utopia Green Power Hour, we've been talking about wind power with Elliot Nagin from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Chris Riley and Ron Zweig from Falmouth, Massachusetts, and Bob Goff from Indian Country. We'll take this up next week. Thank you so much for joining us, Elliot, and everyone have a good week. Join us next week to talk about, in the beginning anyway, wind power and those radioactive tuna from Fukushima being cut off. So we'll take Tokyo, cut off California. Thank you so much, Matt and the crew of PRN, and we'll see you next week in the studio.
All over God's green world. Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore. The fuel ran scarce, the price jumped high. And so they gave nuclear power a try. But don't you know we're gonna have a solar-topia, solar-topia.